Hello and welcome to a new episode of Cooper Talks, and I'm going to call this an exhilarating. No, I think I've done exhilarating. An exultant. Yes, let's have an exultant one, although I'm not sure that's the right term for what's about to transpire, but still, let's keep the theme going. Anyway, welcome to this episode, which is on the Russian Provisional Government between February 1917 and October 1917. That's using the Julian calendar in Russia. Sometimes the dates get a bit confusing because they use a different calendar, but it's always called the February Revolution and the October Revolution. So assuming you have heard my previous podcast, we'd got to the stage where, as a result of issues and problems in World War One that magnified the existing problems in Russia, by February 1917, the Tsar had abdicated and his brother had refused to take power, and as a result there was no government. So very quickly a provisional government, a temporary government, had to be put in place. And I mentioned this at the end of the last talk, but worth just going over it. So no one really knew who was going to take over power. A lot of people assumed the Duma, the ministers involved in the Duma, should be the ones to take over the running of the country. That seemed to make the most sense. However, they hadn't really been properly democratically elected, and a lot of members of the Duma at the time in 1917 were worried that maybe the Tsar or the army would return and they'd be in the firing line. So they were worried, and there was a big discussion. And what they came up with was a compromise. They said, right, what we're going to do is we're going to form a provisional government that will be temporary. And basically, we'll just kind of be a caretaker government. We'll just run things. We'll run the country, keep things going until we can arrange new elections, which can form a constituent assembly. And that would be elections to a constitutional assembly whose job would be to write a new constitution. And this is very much in the mould of kind of what had happened in America back in the 1780s. And although it wasn't a provisional government there, but a constitutional delegation had drawn up, a constitutional assembly had drawn up the American Constitution. And this had been the pattern followed in the French Revolution as well. First revolution, then there was a provisional government, before there was an election for a constitutional government. So that was the theory, at least. The problem was, while they seemed like the obvious choice to, and they were willing to take on the power, they didn't actually control Petrograd, because at the same time, you had the Petrograd Soviet. Now, a Soviet, always worth going over, is kind of like a council of leading union representatives or people whose job was to represent the interests of members. And usually these were representatives from factories and particular areas of a city and so on, who had come together to represent the needs of their members, basically to represent the workers. And in Petrograd, the Soviet had basically seized day-to-day control, and the Soviet was armed and equipped, and basically had the military control over the city and was responsible for law and order and keeping things running. So although the provisional government was seen as the obvious candidate to run the country, realistically, the Petrograd Soviet held the actual power in Petrograd. Now, it's worth bearing in mind, these Soviets were kind of formed spontaneously, and all the major cities in Russia had Soviets being formed at this point. But because Petrograd was the capital, the Petrograd Soviet was the biggest and probably the most important. And one of the first things that the Petrograd Soviet did was issue Order Number 1. And that's why it's called Order Number 1. It was the first one they ordered. And what that basically said was that the Petrograd Soviet had total control over the armed forces in Petrograd, that they all had to answer to the Petrograd Soviet. Basically, the Petrograd Soviet are the bosses. And as a result of that, you end up with a system of dual power, where the provisional government is accepted by everyone as actually being the government, but it can only carry out decisions and make things happen if it has the support of the Petrograd Soviet. And the Petrograd Soviet had this as part of Order Number 1, that the provisional government could only act if it didn't conflict with the orders of the Petrograd Soviet. So they're kind of having to work together here within Petrograd, the provisional government working with the Petrograd Soviet. So it's kind of a liberal middle class revolution, but you've got this strong socialist working class element dominating the Soviets. And in the early years, didn't even last a year, in the early days of the revolution, dual power and the actions of the provisional government seemed to work quite well. It was new, so people were willing to give it a try. And they released political prisoners. They announced freedoms, true freedoms of the press, freedom of speech, right to strike, end to social discrimination, and the death penalty. So this granted an awful lot of freedom to ordinary people, more freedoms than they'd had before, which, yeah, that was very popular. So it was a good starting point. But the provisional government was faced with two major problems, and those were the exact same problems that the Tsar had had, the biggest one being the war. Aside from the Bolsheviks, all the parties in the Duma had to some degree supported the war and continued to support the war. As a result of which, the Petrograd Soviet supports the provisional government in continuing the war. Now, in February 1917, there was optimism and there was hope. And there was a lot of debate over the nature of the war. No one wanted to be defeated by the Russians, by the Germans. They were Russians. No one wanted to be defeated or humiliated. So they didn't want to give up on the war at this stage in February 1917. And there were some people who said it should just be what we call military defensism. And that idea was, you don't go on the offensive, you don't try and attack, okay, Germany, you just try and kind of dig in, dig some trenches and just maintain things where they are. So you keep the war going so Russia's not defeated, but you stop looking to try and win, you stop wasting men and resources fighting it while you sort things out at home. Others wanted the full glory of a victory and thought that might help. Again, the war is going to be a decisive factor for the provisional government. Had the war gone well in 1917, then might have been fantastic. The provisional government probably would have become very popular and might have been successful. As it happened, though, it continued to go badly. And actually, the stream, well, I'll call it a stream rather than a trickle, of soldiers who started deserting in the run-up to the February Revolution now becomes a full cascade and a flood, so to speak. So they start deserting the army, just walking back home in ever greater numbers, while food and fuel supplies remain a massive problem. And for most ordinary Russians, actually, they wanted the war just to end, and they weren't bothered about other things. And this feeling is going to grow the worse things get during the war in 1917. The other issue is land. Now, peasants had demanded land of their own rather than be subjugated to landowners and the nobility and so on. They've been demanding this for a long time. Now the Tsar has gone and there's a new government. The peasants think, right, now is the time. We're going to be given ownership of the land. The provisional government didn't want to do that. It didn't say it was opposed to it, but it felt that this was a pretty major decision. Which it would have been. It would have involved effectively taking land away from some people, the nobility mainly, and the government, and then just giving it to the peasants. And this sort of transfer of Russia's assets and its wealth was thought to be too big for a temporary provisional government that wasn't really elected, effectively, to make this decision. So they said, well, we'll need to wait until we have constitutional elections. They were also worried that if they allowed peasants to just seize land, you just end up with a free-for-all with peasants all taking their land, and with a lot of the soldiers being peasants and from peasant backgrounds, they were worried that they might just leave the army to go home and make sure they got a decent bit of land. So here the peasants are quite early on disappointed by the provisional government. And as it happened, it didn't matter anyway, because a lot of the peasants will just start seizing land and saying, we own this now. And with the military fighting in World War One in Europe, there was really not a lot the government could do. So that creates a volatile situation in the countryside. Okay, so early days, kind of going okay, but it's a bit hit and miss. Now, one of the things that starts to happen in March and April is that a lot of the revolutionaries and the radicals who'd gone into exile under the Tsarist regime started coming back. Now, basically coming back with German help and support. The key one here is Lenin, for our purposes. Lenin was one of many, but it's worth bearing in mind, he'd been in exile for a long time. He'd been living in Switzerland. And he'd wanted to come back to Russia because he saw an opportunity for the Bolsheviks to seize power and gain control over things in the war. But there was a bit of a problem because Russia and Germany were fighting each other. He'd have to travel through Germany and then cross through the Russian lines at the front. And technically, as a Russian, he was an enemy of Germany. And then under the Tsar, he was an enemy of the Russians. So he wouldn't be allowed in. However, with the collapse of the Tsarist regime and the weaknesses of the army, the Germans saw an opportunity to exploit this. And so they said, they gave Lenin, as well as other revolutionaries in Switzerland, basically gave him help and said, do you want to go back to Russia? Yeah, go back. Because they were hoping that he would stir up trouble, which he did. Because he came back, and this, a lot of propaganda elements here. So a lot of heroic paintings of Lenin arriving, making a big speech at Finland Station in Petrograd, loads and loads of loyal supporters there. There really weren't that many at his actual arrival, but it's all tainted by various later issues of propaganda. But Lenin does come back and he takes over the leadership of the Bolsheviks, and he remains committed to his old ideals. So he arrives in April 1917, and he makes a number of demands, the key ones being there should be no cooperation with the provisional government. So he doesn't support the Petrograd Soviet. He said, no, you Menshevik-dominated type of thing. We don't want any cooperation with the provisional government. They're evil, middle-class capitalist types. We don't like them. He said the war had to end straight away. It was a capitalist war, must be ended immediately. All the land should just be given over to the peasants, very popular with the peasants, and that the Soviets should be the instrument to take over. These councils of workers' representatives should take over instead of the provisional government. Now, some of these ideas were quite popular at the time, others less so. Later on, they'd be written up and they were called Lenin's April Theses. Okay, so he's meant to have made this speech as soon as he arrived at Finland Station. That's a bit debatable, but they were written down as the April Theses. And he starts saying there should be a socialist revolution and agitating for that. And amongst his supporters and some of the workers and some of the peasants, there was some popularity. However, most of the Bolsheviks at the time were a bit surprised by this and really didn't think he was that serious. They said, come on, we've got to give the provisional government a chance. You know, we're quite a small party. It's worth bearing in mind that even at the first All-Russian Congress of Soviets that met in June 1917, the Bolsheviks were only the third biggest party. The Socialist Revolutionaries had 285 members. The Mensheviks had 248. The Bolsheviks, 105. So really, the Bolsheviks weren't in a position to seize power. But the Bolshevik party turns it into the April Theses, and they come up with these slogans, bread, peace and land, and all power to the Soviets. And this very much played to the working class audience, particularly about the bread issue. And a number of people wanted to hear it. So Lenin does stir up trouble. He does make issues for the provisional government, and support for the Bolsheviks does start to grow on his return. However, as I mentioned at the All-Russian Congress of Soviets, the Bolsheviks remain very much the third and a relatively minor party in the first half of 1917. So Lenin's return was important, but not that crucial. Now, what then happens is a chain of events, okay, that's going to transform things. So first of all, a key man who's worth bearing in mind at this time is a guy called Kerensky, okay, Alexander Kerensky. Now, Alexander Kerensky was a revolutionary. He was a socialist revolutionary, so not a Marxist, not a Bolshevik or Menshevik, but someone who had campaigned and been involved in revolutionary activities when he was younger. He'd been elected to the Duma in 1912, and he was famous for making amazing speeches, really powerful, kind of socialist revolutionary version of Trotsky in many ways. As such, he was an interesting one because he's a member of the Duma and he will become a key member of the provisional government, initially as the Minister of Justice. But he's also a member of the Petrograd Soviet and he would go to both meetings. So really, as an individual, he was the link or the bridge between the two bodies of dual power, which put him into a really, really important position. And as 1917 goes on, Kerensky becomes more and more important because of this link and because of his skill. He'll become Minister for War in early June and he'll launch an offensive and then he'll end up becoming Prime Minister after something called the July Days, which I'll come to. So Kerensky is kind of the dominant and key figure during this period. Now, in June 1917, under Kerensky's direction, the Russians go on an offensive. They start attacking the German and Austrians on a 120-mile front in the southern part of the battle zone. The hope here was to knock Austria out of the war and put pressure back on. Now, there were problems here, okay? And in many ways, it looks weird. Most Russians were, at best, only okay with military defensivism. In that we don't want to be defeated, but we don't want to go on any big attacks. The stability at home was not there. The revolution was in its early days. There was nothing secure there. And so in a country tired and fed up with war, with an army that was seeing hundreds of 100,000 desertions between February and June 1917, to send a load of troops into battle seemed crazy. There was also the problem that because of the rules laid down by the Soviets, particularly the Petrograd Soviet, soldiers now had soldiers' committees where they basically decide whether or not they were going to follow their officers' armies, which might sound really democratic and egalitarian, but it's not a good move for an effective military, which relies on discipline. So it was a bizarre decision in many ways. The official line that Kerensky gave to the army and the soldiers was that they had to do it first because the Germans were planning a huge attack on Russia combined with Austria. So, you know, if they waited, they basically were using offense as the best form of defense. So they were trying to go on the attack first. That was the official line. There was rumors that this could have happened, but actually there was a lot more to it. One was that under the Tsar in November 1916, Russia had committed with Britain and France to a mid-1917 attack on all sides against Germany to try and weaken Germany and knock it out of the war. And a number of the deputies and ministers of the provisional government felt that if they wanted to keep the money and food and supplies coming from France and Britain, they should probably honour this. So that was part of it, to honour that existing agreement. Again, the defensives thought the offense might be the best way to do it. If they have a big victory, that would mean they could negotiate an end to the war from a position of strength rather than weakness. So rather than saying, oh, Germany, you're about to beat us, please, can we have a peace treaty where the Germans could exact a heavy toll, they argued that if we have a big victory, push the Germans back, then we can negotiate a more favourable peace treaty that will mean we don't lose so much. That was the hope. It would also mean that Britain and France would have to respect Russia more if they'd had a big victory. So there was a method to it. Kerensky, very talented guy, but also big old ego. He believed as Minister of War that if he was able to instigate this big, fantastic offensive and it was victorious, then he would end up becoming Prime Minister. So he was all keen for that. And a lot of the Russian army chiefs, they were fed up with how the army was being run and everything. And they argued that if they had a successful offensive and they recaptured a lot of land, that would give them more weight for reimposing discipline and basically restoring some pride and strength to the Russian military. As it happened, though, it was a complete disaster. Yes, the Russians made some gains early days because they took the Germans by a bit of surprise. But when the Germans counterattacked, the Russian armies just broke and they just turned and ran away. Even worse, they started looting and robbing and doing all sorts of terrible things as they left. And as a result, the German forces advanced 150 miles deeper into Russian territory. So this completely backfires. And as a result of this failure of what was called the June Offensive, or sometimes Kerensky's Offensive, it meant the theory of Russia being able to hold out during the war and maybe wait for a better time, that was over. And the whole theory and basis of the provisional government seemed to be in tatters. And this made the Bolsheviks, the only party opposed to the war, even more appealing. And so after the failures of the June Offensive, you get the July Days. Now, this was not coordinated. It was a spontaneous uprising, and it starts with the 1st Machine Gun Regiment in the Petrograd garrison. So again, this is meant to be under the control of the Petrograd Soviet. It's got about 10,000 men with 1,000 machine guns, so that's quite a lot and quite dangerous. And they mutiny. They mutiny against the provisional government. And again, this is because they want the war to end and they want food and land. All those promises that they were hoping to be met would come through. They basically said, no, we don't want to support the June Offensive. It's rubbish. And they said, we want to stay in the capital and make sure the revolution gets sorted out. So we've had enough. And that then led to them appealing to the other units of the Petrograd garrison and to various radical workers and Soviets across Petrograd. Now, at this point, the party leadership, people like Lenin, they did not support this attempt to seize power, which is odd because Lenin's been championing this for a long time. But at this side, some of the sort of mid-level or low-level Bolshevik organisers join in. And they start appealing for other Bolsheviks to set up and persuade soldiers to seize control of Petrograd. And this then leads to soldiers and workers pouring into the streets on the 16th and 17th of July to protest about the war, to demand the war be over, to insist that the Soviets be given more power. And this kind of haphazard set of protests end up becoming very big, and meaning Petrograd again goes into anarchy and chaos. And the protesters are all focusing on the Bolsheviks as the only anti-war party and saying the Bolsheviks should lead us. They're the only ones who want to end the war. So it seemed at this precise moment, this was what Lenin had been waiting for. This is what he talked about, socialist revolution. It was all there for him. And yet it didn't happen. And we're not entirely sure why, but at this point, Lenin and others say, no, this is not the right moment, okay? This is not the time to be having a revolution, okay? We don't know why Lenin ever said this. Maybe he genuinely did feel this wasn't the time, that if the Bolsheviks seized power in Petrograd, they might hold on for a while, but they didn't have enough support at this stage to be able to make it a reality, which may well have been true. But, you know, opportunities like this don't come along very often. It did seem like Lenin kind of fluffed it a little bit. These demonstrations then turned from political protest into looting and rioting. And eventually the army has to come in to break up the mobs. And Kerensky used this opportunity by sending in the troops and ordering them to sort out the situation. And then using the information he'd gathered as war minister that Lenin had received money and funds from Germany, which was true, to try and destabilize things. This sort of suggested that Lenin was actually an enemy agent working on behalf of the Germans. He was a German spy. This meant Lenin could be arrested. So he fled to Finland and had to shave off his beard and everything to go into disguise. Because apparently without a beard, no one could recognise him. Actually, if you've seen the picture, he does look very different. I think he wore a wig as well. Anyway, or he just kept a hat on. Anyway, other leading Bolsheviks are arrested. The Red Guard, this is a crucial bit, the Red Guard, who were kind of Bolsheviks who were armed, and basically factory workers who were armed to protect the interests of their party's membership, they were forced to disarm Okay, so they were ordered to disarm by the provisional government and the Petrograd Soviet to remove them as a threat. And the Bolsheviks basically look like they've missed their opportunity and it's all a disaster. And they're decimated. Okay, they look like they're gone as a political force now. They've all gone into hiding and basically no longer exist as a party. So although not because of the June offensive, the success of dealing with the July days, which kind of gathered support towards Kerensky. Kerensky ends up being appointed prime minister. So he's basically running Russia now. However, this is the moment where perhaps things could have gone better for the provisional government. Okay. Unfortunately for the provisional government, and very fortunately for the Bolsheviks, things in the real world started to work against Kerensky. Okay, so the success of dealing with the July days had kind of put him in a prime position, but things now will start to go wrong. One of these things is what's called the Kornilov affair. Okay, now I talk about this in a previous podcast, which is called the Kornilov affair, and it'd be well worth reading that. But basically, this undoes all the good work that Kerensky has done in securing Petrograd and disarming the Red Guard. So he basically, Kornilov general, just in a nutshell, sends troops to kind of restore order and deal with the provisional government. So he leads these troops to Petrograd. The people of Petrograd panicked. Kerensky then had to ask the Bolsheviks for their help to persuade their members basically to act as a military defence. So he rearmed the Red Guard, so gives the Bolsheviks weapons, which they will then use in October to seize power. And they come out to defend the city. And also railway workers under Bolshevik influence, actually nothing to do with the Bolsheviks, to be honest. Well, maybe linked. Anyway, railway workers, the working class, they basically stopped the trains from running. So the troops that were coming to suppress Petrograd never actually arrived. But the Red Guard kept hold of their rifles, which they would use a bit later. So now, in short order, the Bolsheviks have gone from being the enemies who were trying to undermine Russia to the saviours of Petrograd. And that made them incredibly popular in the capital city, in Petrograd. As a result of which, they then win elections to the new Petrograd Soviet. And Leon Trotsky, who is now converted to becoming a Bolshevik, is elected chairman. So now Leon Trotsky has become a Bolshevik, and he becomes chairman again of the Petrograd Soviet. So they've got a key member controlling and dominating the Petrograd Soviet, and they've got control over the military, and they've also got their own private army, the Red Guard, who have been armed by the government itself. So they're in the right position here. Also, the situation across Russia was getting worse, and elections were meant to have taken place to the provisional government, not the provisional, to the Constitutional Assembly in September. But because of all the arguments and chaos, the provisional government had decided to postpone those. So it looked again like the provisional government was letting the people down, and people saying, we want the elections. Why? You promised us in September. Why have you delayed them again? And while it might make rational sense, it looked like yet another failing. So it caused greater discontent towards the provisional government. Across the rest of Russia, peasants were seizing land ever more, so the countryside was just in utter chaos. In order to stop this, Kerensky sends out military brigades to try and stop the land seizures, which kind of smacked of Stolypin and his military court martials for peasants back in the wake of 1905. Again, this doesn't win over the peasants. They feel that they're being oppressed and brutalised, and so the peasants turn in ever greater numbers against the provisional government. And soldiers as well are now just deserting in their thousands upon thousands, walking back home, trying to get their share of the land, trying to defend their villages. And to be honest, they really didn't care about the war anymore. Food's rationed in the cities as a result of the chaos in the countryside. So inflation and prices are rising fast. So all the problems that the Tsar faced when he abdicated, they're not only still there, by the autumn of 1917, they're now growing even faster and they're getting worse. So it looks, and in many ways is, the fact that the provisional government are doing a worse job than the Tsar. So there's going to be people saying, well, maybe we should bring back the Tsar, but others saying, no, we need another solution, we need another answer. At this point, Lenin goes, right, now the time is right to seize power. So he's still hiding in Finland, which is part of Russia at the time. Hiding in Finland, he says, right, we need to do it. So he sends them orders, but the other Bolsheviks say, no, we don't want to do it, we don't want to do it. We're worried about how this is going to go. So Lenin has to return to Petrograd in disguise. Okay, maybe, I don't know what he wore, but disguised as someone else. Anyway, and he spent the night arguing with them in person, and Lenin was quite persuasive and quite forceful, and he had this aura about him, and basically convinced all the other Bolsheviks on the night of 23rd of October, although that's on the modern calendar, I need to check the date for that, but basically he persuades the Bolsheviks that the time is now right to seize power straight away. Trotsky, who's the other dominant figure, says, okay, we'll support you, but let's just wait for it, okay? And they wait, and Trotsky puts his plans together. He organises the takeover of Petrograd, okay? They plan for it to happen on the 7th of November, which is the modern calendar, not the Julian calendar at the time. It was quite an open secret, but they were actually plotting. And they said they were going to do it. And Kerensky is trying to stop this from happening. But Trotsky keeps going, keeps organising, getting his plans in action, inspiring the troops, making sure the right people at the right time. And that's a big difference between what happens in October and the failure of the Bolsheviks back in July. This one is led and organised. So the revolution is organised, they are equipped, and they know what the plan is, and they're going to work together. It's not a haphazard bunch of demonstrators. This is a controlled and organised event. So Trotsky's role here is crucial. And Kerensky basically is going around and saying he can't do anything about it. He's trying to find troops to help him, but he's lost the support of all the troops in Petrograd. And so a small group of Bolshevik Red Guards, remember, equipped with rifles by Kerensky, move out into the city. And basically, they're going to storm the Winter Palace and try and take control of the city. And this is a key moment. If the Bolsheviks failed here, if Kerensky got the troops, that would be it. They would be executed as traitors. And that this was their last chance to seize power, and it was a big gamble. They managed to take control over the bridges. If you've ever seen or been to St. Petersburg, it's full of canals and stuff, so the bridges are really important to control the city. They got hold of the telegraph office, they controlled the railway stations and the power stations. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the state of the war and the unpopularity of it, most of the other troops just melted away. When the Red Guards turned up, the regular troops, the regular army just disappeared. Remember as well, they had to answer to the Petrograd Soviet, so that might well have been under Trotsky's orders. The next day, they carried on seizing key places, including the bank, but everything seemed normal, okay? Everything kept working. No one seemed to be taking much notice. And people believed that Kerensky would sort this out once troops arrived. But actually, Kerensky ran away. I mean, that was it. He ran away. And at that moment, the Bolsheviks then went to the Winter Palace, well, the Hermitage, as it's now known, it's a beautiful art gallery. But they went to the Winter Palace, where the provisional government was, to storm the gates. It's not quite as epic as the various movies and stuff made by later communists made it look. It's actually quite a drab affair. But the Red Guard turns up, and the Cossacks who were defending it, well, they'd already left. So, we're not going to die for this. And basically some cadets and a group called the Women's Death Battalion were all that were meant to be defending the Winter Palace. And, eventually the Aurora, which is a ship of a battleship that was staffed with Bolsheviks, they... They fire a blank shot, big loud boom to go off, starts the attack, and there's very little machine gun fire and very little damage done to the palace. The women's death battalion just said, "Nah, we can't be bothered," and they just went back to their camp. So the Red Guards just kind of entered the Winter Palace with no resistance whatsoever. It's not exactly a dramatic story. They basically just walked in. And then they just went through the corridors. And when they did meet military cadets, the cadets just gave up. And when the provisional government was surrounded by the Red Guards, sort of they were all meeting in a room there, they went, "Nah, we can't be bothered fighting you anyway." It was just weight of numbers and loss of any support or allies. And that meant, by the Julian calendar, the October Revolution had happened. And the Bolsheviks, in a very kind of bland way, had managed to seize control over Petrograd, and the provisional government no longer had any power or control. And that effectively is the end of the provisional government and the start of the Bolshevik takeover of power. Okay, now, as I mentioned, the storming of the Winter Palace is often portrayed in various films and movies and communist propaganda as this great huge dynamic moment where there's resistance and they're charging through the streets and all persuade. It really wasn't like that. It was a well-organized and well-coordinated revolution, but there was very little resistance, which showed the provisional government in Petrograd, at least, had lost all semblance of support. So it wasn't as big a deal as it would later be made to seem in history. What's more important to remember is that the Bolsheviks had gained control over Petrograd, the capital city, which was important, but they only controlled the city. They did not automatically control the whole of Russia. And that's what I'm going to look at next time, how the Bolsheviks built their power, developed their power, and would eventually come to a position where they were in total control over the whole of Russia. But that was quite a lot of info there. But that was the provisional government. I think the key things there to realise the importance of the war, the fact that while people have blamed the Tsar, the removal of the Tsar did not solve the problems that had existed. And the provisional government in the end couldn't solve those problems either, as well as making their own catastrophic mistakes. And in a sense, by failing to deal with the core issues of war and food and prices, and without having the support of the military, the provisional government really wasn't in a very strong position. Lenin will learn from this, and he does have a reputation as a result of, you know, he's got a lot of popular support because the Bolsheviks and he were always against the war, which is what the Russians are all against. And so he's got that popular standing, but he's also going to use some of the Tsar's previous methods of control and intimidation to assert the Bolshevik domination. But that's for another time. So we've got Lenin as a key individual, Trotsky as a key individual, Kerensky as a key individual, worth bearing in mind, worth listening to the Kornilov affair, and just thinking about why the provisional government failed and why the Bolsheviks ended up being able to seize control over Petrograd in October 1917. Well, I hope that's been of use. The next one will be the Bolsheviks in power, and I'll see how far I can get with these early in January. Anyway, take care and yeah, enjoy. I hope you found that exultant. No, that doesn't make any sense. Anyway, goodbye for now.